This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the interview Terry recently recorded with brothers Dave and Phil Alvin. They've made their first full album together in nearly 30 years. Back in 1979, they co-founded the roots rock band The Blasters. Phil, the older brother by 2 years, sang lead and played guitar. Dave played lead guitar and wrote many of the band's songs, including their most famous ones, Marie Marie and American Music. Dave left the band in 1986. He became the lead guitarist of the band X and went on to a solo career. Phil's continued performing with The Blasters. When Dave and Phil were growing up in the 1960s, they were obsessed with blues and R&B music. Their latest album, Common Ground, is a tribute to one of their early influences, bluesman Big Bill Brunzi. It includes 12 of his songs, including his most famous, Key to the Highway. Before we hear Terry's interview with Dave and Phil Alvin, let's listen to the opening track from their new album. This is Big Bill Brunzi's song, All by Myself.
Just around the world. When I get back, I'm gonna have diamonds and pearls. All by myself.
All by myself.
All by myself.
All by myself.
I didn't have no one to help me. Had to do it all by myself.
Locked up in jail, it weren't no hanging crime. But now I'm on the farm, boys, and I'm doing time. All by myself.
All by myself.
All by myself.
All by myself.
I didn't have no one to help.
Dave Alvin, Phil Alvin, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. Congratulations on the new album.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
This is your first album together in about 30 years. Why is it the music of Big Bill Brunzi that you decided to do after getting back together?
We wouldn't fight. We wouldn't disagree. We wouldn't argue about Big Bill Brunzi. And Phil and I have both in the past few years lost our closest friends and kind of realized that we're not immortal. And so I decided we've never really made a record, just the two of us. You know, we were always, quote unquote, in The Blasters. So I thought, let's go to square one, someplace where we agree. And I won't have to write 10, 12 songs and then us fight about the lyrics or this, that, and the other. Let's just go do a record for the Alvin brothers. So that was it.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you saying, if you did, Dave, if you wrote original songs, you'd be fighting about the lyrics.
well,
what would the fight be about?
Well, who knows? You know, that's the thing. You know, it's, you know, when you're writing songs for someone else to sing, you have to write songs that you and that person agree with or feel the same way. And that's 9 out of 10 times that's my brother and I are in total accord on that. But there's always that possibility of the 10th time. And the other thing was, it just felt right. My brother and I, when we were little kids, we were little record collector guys, and we had all sorts of Huckleberry Finnish misadventures and you know, collecting old 78s, and we never really made a record for those two little kids, and that was what I wanted to do.
Since you've both brought your guitars with you and you're willing to sing a little for us, can I ask you to do what is probably the best-known Big Bill Brunzi song, which is Key to the Highway, and you do it on the new album, but if you could do it for us in the studio, that would be fantastic.
Sure.
Sure.
And tell us who's going to be doing what.
I'm going to be messing up on guitar.
that's Phil speaking, yeah.
I'm playing the resonator guitar, and Phil's playing the standard Martin. You know, I when we made the record, I wanted to delineate between the two guitars, you know, because if we were both playing, you know, Martins, it would sound pretty cluttered. So Big Bill never played with a resonator, so that's, we're already breaking rule number one. So.
Is it the resonator anyway, the one you just played?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the key to the highway, filled up and bound to go. I'm gonna leave here running, 'cause walking is most too slow. I'm going back to the border, girl, where I'm better known. 'Cause you never done nothing but drove a good man away from home. Now when I leave this time, baby, girl, I won't be back no more. I'm gonna roam this highway till the break of day.
That was Dave and Phil Alvin performing the big Bill Brunzi song, Key to the Highway. And they're performing in the studio, but that song is also on their new album, Common Ground. Dave Alvin and Phil Alvin play and sing the songs of big Bill Brunzi. So earlier when I asked you why, after 30 years, you decided to do an album together, Dave and Phil performed together in the Blasters, you said, among other things, that you both had close friends who died, and you realized that you're not immortal. And Phil, you had been very sick, in fact, and must have realized for sure that you're not immortal. What actually happened?
Well, I went to Spain with the Blasters, and on the way over there, an abscess tooth went off while I was up in the plane, and it apparently got into my blood system. So we played a gig in Valencia. During the last song of the show, the right side of my throat swelled up instantly like a balloon. So they took me to an emergency hospital, and when I got there, I was told that I flatlined, and a wonderful angel doctor, Dr. Mariela Anaya Cifuentes, said that she clubbed me back into existence. And I woke up 2 days later with a hole in my throat, because then they perform a tracheostomy. And I stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks, and then I came home with a hole in my throat, which eventually healed over.
That doctor got to do what I always wanted to do, club my brother. Lucky.
Dave, how did you find out that Phil was sick?
I got a phone call in the middle of the night, you know. And it was sounding kind of dark here. You know, the first phone call was, your brother's dead. And so then my immediate response is, okay, I have to, you know, I called my sister and you know, gee, what do we do to get the body? I guess we have to fly over there and pick up the body and maybe, you know, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff, you know. And then an hour later, you get a phone call saying, he's not dead, he's brain dead. And then about half an hour after that, you get a call saying, no, he's fine, he's okay, you know, he's breathing. It was really unnerving, you know, to say the least.
How soon were you able to get there?
Oh, I didn't go. I had gigs. No, we sent our cousin. It was after 1 day we knew that he was okay. He was alive and everything was, you know, more or less fine. It was just an insane period, and you know, I'm glad he's okay.
So Phil, when you woke up with a hole in your throat, did you think, well, great, I'm alive, but I'll probably like never sing again?
I thought that a little bit. I immediately tried to start talking, and, you know, you can't really until you put your finger over the hole of the tube that's sticking out of the tracheostomy. But I was pretty much singing a couple of days later when Dr. Mariela came in. I told her, I said, well, I'm a singer, you know, and I started singing. So I could tell that my vocal cords were okay, and I even yodeled a little bit. But, yeah, it was pretty close to the moneymaker, and that was a very scary thing, you know. And I think I've recovered, but I'm still recovering or relearning who I am. As a singer, your confidence has a great deal to do with what you do, and my confidence was certainly shaken.
I would love it if you would each play an excerpt of a song that deeply influenced you during your formative years when you were first introduced to the blues and trying to learn blues styles as singers or guitarists?
Yeah.
So this is Phil Alvin.
This is Phil Alvin. I'm trying to think. here's a song called Santa Fe by Lightning Hopkins, who was a guy that really I used to go see all the time and influenced me a great deal. And I'll see if I can play it. I hid up on a mountain, stowed away on the Santa Fe. I hid up on a mountain, stowed away on the Santa Fe. See, I'm leaving my baby, going to my old time used to be. It's a shame, it's a shame. Do me like you do. It's a shame, it's a shame. The way you do me like you do. Yeah, but someday, baby, it's all coming home.
Well, that's great. Thank you. That was Phil Alvin playing and singing a Lightning Hopkins song. And Lightning Hopkins had a really like deep voice, and you know, later in his career, he was kind of like talking his way through songs. And I feel like I heard you deepen your voice for that.
Yes. Well, yeah, you have to deepen your voice to sound like Lightning. He was such a great performer, and I would go and see him every time that he would come to town. My mother would drive me down till I could drive. And he was just a magnificent performer and storyteller. What a fantastic musician, and also had a very long career.
Lightning Hopkins was like a shaman, you know. He was one of those kind of characters. He was from another time and another place. He could certainly take you there.
Dave, I had asked Phil to perform a song that was very influential for him when he was going through his formative years. Can you do one for us that deeply influenced you when you were
sure.
young and introducing yourself to the blues?
Yeah, well, I'll do a song that's kind of a combination of Big Joe Turner and T-Bone Walker. I remember the very first time I ever saw both those guys, it was the same bill. It was my brother had a carload of guys, and they allowed me to jump in to go see the Johnny Otis Orchestra at the Ashgrove. And it was, you know, full horn section, Johnny Otis playing vibes and piano, you know. And it was like a review, you know. And part of the review was the headliners were Eddie Cleanhead Vincent, the great urban jump blues singer, and then T-Bone Walker, you know, the brilliant guitarist, and then Big Joe Turner. And they were all still close enough to their prime that it was just a stunning, stunning evening, you know, life-changing, you know, that was it. You know, I left the club that night, I think both my brother and I, and there's kind of no doubt what we'd wind up doing. And we followed Big Joe and T-Bone around, you know, kind of like deadheads. We were, you know, boneheads or Joeheads, whatever we would be called. And so I'll do a thing that's sort of a combination of T-Bone guitar and a Joe Turner song called Chains of Love. Now, I can't sing it like Joe Turner, but my brother can, so maybe he'll come over and punch me and take over here.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, here's Chains of Love. Chains of love, I cried my eyes out over you. Chains of love leaving me alone and so blue. And now I am your prisoner. Tell me, what are you gonna do? Are you gonna love me? Are you gonna make me cry? Are you gonna leave me? Are you gonna say bye-bye? These chains of love are gonna haunt me, mama, till the day I die.
Dave Alvin playing a song by Big Joe Turner?
Yeah.
Who was most famous for Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
Yeah, and Chains of Love was his first big hit, R&B hit, on when he signed with Atlantic. But, you know, Big Joe Turner was kind of like Big Bill Brunzi in that they were survivors, you know. And I think one of the things that both my brother and I learned from those guys, you know, wasn't necessarily the musical part of it. It's the survival skills.
So when you started going to clubs and meeting people like Big Joe Turner, how old were you?
Well, I was about 13 or 14 when I started having my mother. In fact, I think I was 12 when I had my mother drive me to see Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. But I met Joe Turner when I was 15. About 6 months before I could drive. And so by the time I was 16, you know, I was playing in bands with Joe Turner and T-Bone Walker.
And Dave, you were 2 years younger, so were you going to clubs when you were 11?
12-ish, yeah. Our mom was very understanding. She had been a contortionist and a small-time vaudeville dancer in the 30s.
Wow, really? A contortionist?
Yeah.
She was fantastic.
Yeah. I never knew that until I was in my late teens, and these photos from the 1933 appeared of my mother in these just, you know, intense contortionist poses with her head behind her. If you knew my mother, you would be shocked that she could do that. But, yeah, she had a rotten first husband who kind of squashed her dreams of being, you know, performer. And so she kind of, she wasn't a stage mother in any way, shape, or form, but she was, our mother encouraged passion in a certain way. So she would drive me and my brother to shows, you know. My mother drove me to see Jimi Hendrix, and when I was 12 or 11, and she took my friend and I, Joe Sinkak, and she just said, don't eat anything, don't drink anything, you know. And she'd sit and wait in the car, so... You know, she kind of encouraged that in us. She wasn't always happy that we were sneaking into bars or going to shows, but she understood. And
how'd they let you in if you were so young?
Well, when I was going to the bars in South Central, I looked a little older for my age, but nobody ever asked me ever for any ID, ever.
Can I ask you to perform an excerpt of the most famous of the Blaster songs that you wrote, Dave, and that would be Marie Marie? And maybe you could tell us the story behind the song, too?
Yeah, it was one of the earliest songs that I wrote. I don't think it was the first, but it was the third or fourth. And, yeah, I was laying in my bed kind of excited about suddenly being in a band and being a guitar player. And so I'd have these songs rolling around in my head, and the sort of melody and everything kind of came to me, and I thought, well, this would be a great Cajun Balfa Brothers kind of song, and then if you put it to a Chuck Berry beat, this might be pretty cool. But I couldn't think of any lyrics, and we had a rehearsal the next evening, and so all that day I was walking around humming this melody, and I was like, what's it about? What's it about? You know, 'cause I had no idea how to write songs at that point. I still don't, but I really didn't have any idea then, and I just, whatever I was doing that day, you know, just living inside my brain. And then the reality was, about 30 minutes before we left to go to rehearsal, I sat down at our kitchen table and I just wrote the lyrics as came to me. I was kind of, I remember being a little kid and we were driving down this road up near the Puente Hills, and there was an old Victorian farmhouse, and there was a girl sitting on the porch with a guitar. And for whatever reason, that image stuck with me, and so then I just wrote that. So, like, in 20 minutes, we had this.
Marie Marie, playing guitar on the back porch. I sit in my car while you sing. So sad, Marie Marie. Marie Marie, it's so lonely in these farmlands. Please come with me to the bright lights downtown, Marie Marie. I said, hey, pretty girl, don't you understand? I just want to be your loving man, Marie Marie. The sun is down in the cornfields, the evening is dark, and you sing so sad, Marie Marie.
That's great. Thank you both for doing that. And that was Dave Alvin playing guitar, Phil Alvin singing. They have a new album together. They're performing in the studio, but they have a new album together called Common Ground, which features the songs of the bluesman Big Bill Brunsey. So how does it feel knowing that one of your early songs was so successful?
It's a little intimidating. You know, it was intimidating at the time because an English singer named Shakin' Stevens heard it, and heard it on an independent record we made, and he cut it and had an international hit with the song everywhere but the United States. And this, we didn't even have a record deal yet, you know, and he's having a big, huge record. And so he called me up, and Shakin' Stevens didn't want to know if I had more songs. I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't really write songs, you know. I was a little stumped, so it's intimidating to have, like, the third or fourth song you ever wrote suddenly become this international hit, and you're getting these royalty checks that are, they're, you know, we're really kind of like, huh, you know? And, you know, where did all this come from? You know, your old songs, every time you sit down to write songs, all your old songs come and visit, and they kind of, like, hang around behind you, and they look over your shoulder at what you're working on, and they're saying, like, nope, that's not one of us. That's not good enough. You know, so, and it's really true. It's, you know, songwriting is so weird, and everybody does it differently. Everybody's got their own ways of doing it, and it's not something you teach, like, you know, you can teach someone how to build a house. You know, you start with the foundation and work up. But in songwriting, you can start with the roof and work down. You know, there's no rules, really. So I'm a self-taught songwriter, so because I'm self-taught and because one of the earliest things was a hit, it doesn't make sense. To this day, it still doesn't make sense to me.
So it sounds like the success of Marie Marie helped inspire you to keep writing songs.
Yeah, I liked writing songs, you know, but I never thought that I was a songwriter. You know, I just kind of stumbled into it, you know. It was like the Blaster, you know, I wrote songs as a kid in my brain and sang them and drove my mom crazy as she drove me around in the 49 Studebaker when I was 5 years old. In fact, we can even do one of the songs. One of them, was sort of my attempt at Lieber and Stoller at 5 years old.
Oh, I want to hear this.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you listen to the, I'd spin the car radio, you know, and that's what was on the radio. But yeah, I wrote a Lieber and Stoller song that it's horrible, but it's the first thing I wrote, which was, let's see, well, I don't know, you don't care, but I don't know, you don't care. You don't care. What you mean you don't care? Well, I don't know. And you don't care. Yeah, I don't know. And you don't care. What you mean you don't know? You know, that was, I would do that for hours, drive my mom nuts.
That's very yakety yak.
And yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's Lieber and Stoller. If the Coasters are making a record, I've got a song for them. you know, so... Yeah, it's intimidating to have a big hit record when you're still living in your bedroom at your parents' house.
Oh, that's funny, actually.
And you're working as a fry cook in a Middle Eastern joint, you know. Yeah.
But it probably got you out of there, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we have time for one more song. And you did a video while on a train, I think in a blizzard.
Yeah.
of James Brown's Please, 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 like you two performed it on the train, and it is so much fun. Can I ask you to do a version of that for us now and tell us why you decided to do it in the first place?
The reason that I ever thought of doing Please, Please, Please was they have an Elvis Presley show here in Los Angeles every year. I guess it's January 9th or January 8th. And we would go and play, and you know, you're supposed to play Elvis Presley songs. And the year that James Brown died, which was right around Christmas, the Blasters went to play the show, and I was so broken up about James Brown, and I thought it was ridiculous that we didn't do something for him. So I just told the band, let's do Please, 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 which I had rarely sung, and it came off pretty good, and so we started doing it in the show all the time. It's kind of rough to do acoustically. I'll try to do it sitting down.
All right.
Let me hear an E. Please, 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 please. You so, baby, you did me wrong. Whoa, whoa, you done me wrong. Oh, you done me wrong. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Took my love, and now you're gone.
Dave and Phil Alvin performing James Brown's Please, Please, Please. The Alvin's latest album, Common Ground, features the brothers performing songs by bluesman Big Bill Brunzi. Coming up, Terry talks hangovers with Adam Rogers, author of the new book, Proof, The Science of Booze. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. It can be nice to relax with a glass of wine, a beer, or a cocktail, but one drink too many, and you'll be paying the price. To understand why drinking can make us feel so good and so bad, you have to know a little about science, which is why our guest, Adam Rogers, wrote the book Proof, The Science of Booze. Rogers is the articles editor at Wired and formerly covered science and technology for Newsweek. Terry spoke with Adam Rogers earlier this month.
Adam Rogers, welcome to Fresh Air. You say, over the past 5 years, researchers have revealed that pretty much everything anyone has ever told you about the causes of hangover is wrong. So, what are some of the things that people had assumed were right that turn out to be wrong?
Well, the famous one is probably dehydration, right? like everybody will tell you, oh, it's because alcohol dehydrates you, and that's what's causing the hangover. And
right, right. And so therefore, you're told drink a lot of water as you're drinking alcohol, right. And that will help.
Yeah, exactly. Or like alternate, or have a big glass of water before you go to bed. And some of that comes from the fact that you do get dehydrated, but in fact, the dehydration does not seem to be what's causing the hangover. You can fix the dehydration, and you're still hungover.
Okay, so we got rid of that one. Is it because your blood sugar is affected?
It is probably not the case that blood sugar is, again, what's causing the hangover. When you drink, your blood sugar levels are affected, but by the time you're hungover, your blood sugar levels are back to normal. And drinking a Gatorade or some other sports drink that changes your blood sugar levels doesn't seem to affect the hangover either.
Okay, what else were you told in the past about how to avoid a hangover that turns out to be scientifically wrong?
Well, there's that thing about mixing your drinks, right?
Drinking
beer and then drinking wine and then drinking, right? Again, no, you can do the study where you have somebody drinking the same drink and getting to the same blood alcohol level and somebody drinking different drinks and getting to the same blood alcohol level. And they both get the same hangover. They both report the same symptoms. And similarly, like, If you say, well, okay, maybe it's like impurities in the alcohol, so it's, I'm going to stick to vodka, you know, because that's pure somehow, it's just ethanol and water, right? Instead of drinking bourbon or drinking tequila or something, right? And there have been actually a couple of studies. The problem is they're kind of crummy. They were presented at conferences. They're not peer-reviewed. And they were very small populations where people did report a worse hangover for something like brandy than they did for vodka, but everybody got the hangover. Right. You still have those bad outcomes.
Okay. So we've dismissed some of the things that we've all been told will help prevent hangover. What have scientists learned in the past 5 years that might help us avoid a hangover?
Well, a couple of interesting things. One thing that scientists have started to figure out is that hangovers have a lot of symptomatic overlap with migraines. They look a lot like a migraine.
I could have told them that. They didn't need to do a lot of research.
Yes. Thank you, science. Well, it turns out they did. Actually, it wasn't until very recently that the researchers who studied hangovers even had a shared kind of language or vocabulary to talk about them. They didn't even have a survey instrument that they could use to give people to have a reliable account of like whether your hangover was worse than mine or different from mine. And part of the issue here, too, is that hangovers have different symptoms for different people, right? Some people wear their hangovers in their guts and some people have horrible headaches, but we still see all of those things as a hangover. For a while, the only thing that people would have in common in terms of describing their hangover is they would say, I have a hangover, but everything else was different. So they finally got around that. They finally have a survey instrument that they can give somebody and assess, you know, you have a level 9 hangover and you have a level 7 hangover. And they finally started to see that overlap with both migraine and also with an inflammatory response. So the kind of thing that you would have if you had the flu, let's say, right, where you feel achy and you feel slow and your brain doesn't work as fast and you just kind of general malaise. And so looking at that, they could go, well, okay, let's see if in fact this isn't an inflammation. And if you look at people with hangovers, the same markers in the blood that you would see with an inflammatory response, things like cytokines, for example, which are a molecule that the immune system uses to talk to itself, actually do seem elevated. And even better, you can induce what looks like a hangover by giving somebody those same molecules, you can administer them, and then you get symptoms that look like a hangover. So that's good news, because if you say, well, if it's an inflammatory response, then maybe I can go at it with anti-inflammatory drugs. And we have those.
Well, we have those, but do they work for hangover?
The study that is the one that most people refer back to on this used a drug called Clotam. And Clotam is a sort of, it's like a super-powered anti-inflammatory. It's prescribed for migraines in Europe. And in fact, it did work, that it did seem to alleviate a lot of the symptoms of hangover. Now, the problem is that it's not in the U.S. pharmacopoeia. You can't get it here. I tried. But there are obviously other anti-inflammatories that we get over the counter, ibuprofen, things like that. The problem is that things like ibuprofen have side effects, potentially dangerous ones if you take a lot of them, that are in some ways synergistic with the effects of a hangover. So if you drink too much, you have a lot of gastrointestinal issues, for example, right? There hasn't been a good study, peer-reviewed with a lot of people in it, looking at things like Advil, looking at the kind of stuff you can get over the counter. Nobody's actually done that yet. They've only done it with the sort of prescription strength, high-powered anti-inflammatories.
So you're saying that the jury's still out about whether over-the-counters are really going to be effective with hangover?
Yeah, and
other,
I think the real
other
issue,
than the way everybody already uses them, which is,
yeah, exactly.
My God, I have a hangover.
The issue there is also like how often you're going to be doing that, you know?
Right, right. And so I'm surprised you didn't fly to France as part of your research to test out this drug that you say isn't available in the United States but was used in this anti-inflammatory hangover study.
You know, that actually would have been a really good reporting move.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Next book.
So, you know, we were talking earlier about myths about hangover that scientists have disproven. One of the long-term remedies for a hangover is hair of the dog. The next morning, you have a drink.
Right.
Scientifically, does that work?
Well, there is a good story about why it might work, although this is very, very hypothetical. And that is the idea that that a hangover is caused by methanol toxicity. So methanol is another kind of alcohol, right? Alcohols as a class are a class of molecules in organic chemistry. Ethanol is the one that we drink to feel like we've been drinking. But in any preparation of fermenting and especially distilling, you'll get a little bit of methanol too. And if there's too much, that's that. It's the stuff that makes you go blind in bad moonshine, right? But there's a notion that in small amounts, it might be what's causing symptoms of a hangover too. And when you're treating methanol toxicity in a hospital, if you show up in an ER with methanol toxicity, they'll give you a big dose of ethanol because it displaces the methanol off that enzyme. It keeps the enzyme from breaking it down into the toxic stuff. So the idea is, well, maybe the hair of the dog is like that. Maybe the hair of the dog is you're giving yourself ethanol, and that's displacing the methanol, and so you feel better. That's all very hypothetical. And the real bummer there is that the people who admit to using hair of the dog as a treatment for their hangovers, they turn out to be the ones more likely to have an alcohol dependency later in life.
That's not a surprise.
It has some intuitive power, yes.
But the thing is, I thought that most alcohol that we'd be drinking that's legit doesn't have methanol in it. So how would the ethanol help?
These will be trace amounts. If you drink enough, then the trace amounts add up, and it's just enough to give you the kind of discomfort, the symptoms of a hangover.
So you're referring to the alcohol that's in, you know, liquor, beer, or wine as ethanol. I've always thought of ethanol as something that's mixed in with gasoline at the pump, and it's used as an alternate fuel made out of corn. So what, when you say that the alcohol we drink is ethanol, what exactly is that?
Well, so those are all the same thing. You're right. And alcohols are a class of molecules in organic chemistry. So it's just a combination of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens in a particular order. And depending on how many of those and what order you have them and how they're built together, you can have, methanol is an alcohol, ethanol is an alcohol. The kind of alcohol and the rubbing alcohol you buy as a to sterilize a cut, you know, is another kind of alcohol. But ethanol is the one that we drink, and it's the one with the psychoactive effects, and that's not doesn't have the toxicity that some of the other ones would. And it also, because there's a lot of energy packed into the bonds in the molecule, packed into the chemical bonds that hold the molecule together, it's also possible to use as a fuel, just like gasoline.
Now that you've done a lot of research for your book about the science of booze, and you've interviewed distillers and winemakers, and you've done a lot of tastings, you've traveled around, are there things that you will not drink anymore that you used to? Because, you know, you basically, after learning about how it's made or what its effect on you is, you lost your interest in it?
So I've kind of stopped drinking cheap Slivovitz, which I used to drink every once in a while, mostly at Passover, because I can sort of identify off flavors in it.
Plum brandy?
It's a plum brandy, that's right. And there are a few small distilleries making whiskey that I don't drink anymore, even though I love the craft distilling movement and I like whiskey a lot, because for me now, I now, having been exposed to some flavors that come from aging whiskey in small barrels, which tastes different than if you age the whiskey for a longer time in a larger barrel. And I don't like those flavors. So I've stopped drinking those.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Adam Rogers is the author of the new book, Proof, The Science of Booze. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says there's something about a rapidly strummed guitar chord, followed quickly by an urgent vocal, that helps define an effective rock song. Ken's found quite a few examples on Benjamin Booker's self-titled debut album. The 25-year-old guitarist, singer, songwriter has already served as an opening act on Jack White's recent tour. Ken says he may be ready for headliner status.
There's a raw yet disciplined energy running through Benjamin Booker's debut album. He comes on all out of control, impassioned, torn up in love. But just a few listens and you begin to appreciate the craftsmanship and thought that's gone into creating this music. The song that began this review is called Violent Shiver, a phrase that aptly describes one possible reaction to hearing the doomsday romance scenario that Booker lays out in the lyric. On another song, Always Waiting, Booker commences slowly. You think after the first 30 seconds that the tune is going to be a ballad or a dirge, a feeling seemingly confirmed by the lyric, which is addressed to a young woman with a strong spiritual life. But then Booker's guitar picks up the pace and he starts getting impatient, urging the girl to abandon her faith and come with him. He's got some devil in him, for sure.
Always working, always working, God is working, God is working, always searching, always searching, devil's working, devil's working, fade away, our love fade away, our love fade away.
Raised in Tampa, Florida, and moving back and forth between there and New Orleans, Benjamin Booker has a lot of Southern soul in his blues rock. When he slows down the tempo, you can hear the grit and the moan in his voice with a starkness that still doesn't make all the details clear. A song such as Slow Coming takes off from what Booker describes as a news report about a little girl shot while bending down to tie her shoes. It sends him into a tailspin of despair, as though he thinks nothing in life is ever going to become easier, better, more humane.
At the top of the hour, today in the knees, little girl is shot down, but dying as she. Down!
Benjamin Booker has cited influences ranging from the blues man Blind Willie Johnson to the L.A. punk band The Gun Club as influences, emphasizing a broad spectrum for the vehemence of his often blaring sound. The way he growls and tears away at syllables and phrases, pitching his voice low, he sounds much older than a guy in his 20s. It's as though he wants to, right out of the gate, sound like he's been around, that he knows the score. So does his drummer, Max Norton, as you can hear on this pounding track. There's another element in play in Benjamin Booker's music, one that adds tension to this album. His relationships with women, lovers, friends, a sister, are characterized by a protectiveness that can seem alternately considerate and controlling. Booker's honesty, his awareness of this, just makes the intensity of the music all the more intriguing. You're left really wanting to hear where this guy is going next and who he wants to take along for the ride.
Ken Tucker reviewed the debut album from Benjamin Booker.
It's a lonely walk with a girl like that, my girl. You ain't seen no love since a memoir at your door.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.